The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. Such a pleasure to be here. I'm Nikhil Saval, the state senator for the 1st Senate District, which we are in right now. And I'm proud to welcome, for the first time, another Nikhil Goyle, to the stage here at the Free Library. So first, it's a beautiful book, and we're excited to dig in. But it is, a work of nonfiction and reportage and journalism, is also an incredible literary achievement. So I really want to, I think there's ways to bring that out. And so we're going to start with a little bit of a reading first, and then we'll get into some questions.
Emmanuel tried to zone out the cruelty. When it came to his weight, there was not much he could do. His neighborhood was a food desert with little access to affordable, nutritious meals. And he was in the second hungriest congressional district in the nation, where half the households with children went short. Yvette often used up her monthly food stamps in a single trip to the store, forcing the family to ration the final week or two of the month or buy on credit. Emmanuel was always anxious about where his next meal would come from, so when he did have food, he feasted. Michael Harrington's description of people, fat with hunger, fat from cheap food, fit Emmanuel's family. Their carb diet featured helpings of rice, beans, and chicken, and endless servings of fast food from establishments such as Kentucky Fried Chicken, Burger King, McDonald's, and the nearby Chinese store, where they ordered pork fried rice, lo mein, chicken wings, and egg rolls. Emmanuel and Yvette loved their delicious homemade lemonade. The sugary drink calmed her hot temper. Affording the school uniform was another issue. The dress code at Esperanza was a light blue collared shirt, navy sweater vest, navy tie with yellow stripes, navy slacks, and black dress shoes, all of which had to be purchased from a designated vendor. The bill came to more than $100 with no financial aid from the school. Emmanuel alternated between two sets. He outgrew his shirts quickly, so Yvette would buy cheap ones from the discount store and sew on the logo herself. The house did not have a washer or dryer, so she had to wash the uniform by hand and dry it by double-fisting an iron and a hairdryer. But sometimes it wouldn't dry in time, and Emmanuel would get teased by his classmates because his shirt was stained or smelled of sweat. Emmanuel took to his Facebook feed without revealing the precise source of his trouble. "I have such a broken home, but yet still I try to smile, even though the pain is so unbearable as I watch us slowly drift away, the memories just fading away without remembering the past. I don't even know who to call family anymore. I guess I'm alone, slowly fighting, but being strong isn't easy as it is in the movies. Holding back tears may be the strongest thing I have to do. But stay true, live life, things happen for a reason." He tried praying to God, pleading, "Please don't make me gay. Please don't make me gay. Please don't make me gay." He hoped he could pray the gay away. His worst fear was of God taking vengeance and depositing him at the gates of hell. Esperanza didn't help. During a makeup test, as he doodled zigzags on a Scantron sheet, he overheard the two proctors talking about the upcoming presidential election. The men agreed that they wouldn't vote for President Barack Obama because he had endorsed legalizing same-sex marriage. "I will never be somebody in life," Emmanuel thought, and he would never feel safe or accepted at Esperanza. Eventually, following exhaustive searches online, Googling phrases such as "how to know if you're gay" and "how to be gay and Christian," as well as reading blogs and articles, Emmanuel came to believe that homosexuality and Christianity weren't necessarily mutually exclusive. He could be spared the wrath of God. He had already hinted about it to Omar, and now, a day before his 7th birthday, he called his friend Angelina from Conwell and came out as bisexual. He didn't close the door on the possibility that he might like girls, and this was easier than accepting that he only liked boys. "Now we can fawn over guys together," she exclaimed. He had a low-key birthday party with her and Omar, comforted that his friends treated him no differently. A week later, Angelina suggested that he tell his mother. Coming out to his friends would have been relatively painless, but Yvette was a wholly different breed. A card-carrying evangelist, of Pentecostal Christianity. At best, she wouldn't care. At worst, she would disown him and excommunicate him from the household. And he had no way of knowing where her reaction would land on the spectrum. But he realized that he didn't want to hide it from her forever and knew she would find out eventually. It would be better coming from him than from rumor and gossip. To prepare, Emmanuel binge-watched dozens of coming-out videos on YouTube and tried to craft the simplest way of breaking the news. He woke up that morning with a feeling in his stomach he described as a paper cut that wouldn't stop bleeding. But this time I was bleeding out my truth. He called softly to his mother. "I want to tell you something," he said. "Mom, I think I'm bisexual." "What? So you like boys too?" Yvette said. "You know, God destroyed two cities because of that, Sodom and Gomorrah." She teared up. "I need time to process this." Emmanuel tried to put on a show of strength. "Cool," he said. "There's nothing you can do about it. I'm bisexual." She disappeared into her bedroom. He imagined her thinking that her youngest child was her biggest disgrace. Eventually, Yvette came out and gave him a hug. "No matter what you feel at this moment," she said, "I'm there to support you. I love you no matter what you are. I'm going to love you always." But in the next breath, she worried he would catch AIDS. Emmanuel explained that this was a hurtful stigma attached to the LGBTQ community. Despite his mother's vow of solidarity, Emmanuel didn't truly feel relieved or liberated. He didn't think she would fully accept who he was, and she was the entirety of his family. He had no one else to turn to. His father had disappeared, Joaquin was in residential care, and Emmanuel and Michael weren't talking much since Michael had moved out of the city. But when Emmanuel finally opened up to his brother, Michael didn't judge or look at him differently and said that he shouldn't feel inadequate. Over the next several weeks, Emmanuel saw that his mother became increasingly distant. He stopped going to school. He cried and take freezing baths to remind himself that he was still alive. At night, he stared at the broken drywall above his head, imagining painless ways to end his life and pay for his misdeeds. In his misery, he went to YouTube and discovered Davey Wavy's channel, which covered coming out, dating, sex, and other LGBTQ issues. He was reminded that he was not alone, that there was nothing immoral about his attraction, and his suffering would not be eternal. The pain and turmoil were not uncommon for people coming out of conservative religious families, and his mother's reaction could have been much worse. Being persistently miserable was not the life he envisioned. With the help of the internet, he slowly, day by day, began to accept all his multitudes.
Beautiful. Thank you for that reading, Nikhil, and welcome again to Philadelphia, or I should say back to Philadelphia. For Live to See the Day, congratulations on the book. It's an incredible achievement. It's a beautiful portrait of, or rather I should say a searing, but also quite beautiful portrait about poverty, about childhood, about the inequalities in education, urban inequalities, racial inequalities, gender justice and injustice. But you know, it's hard not to feel for me, and for those of you that have read the book or will read the book, it is also a very great Philadelphia book, and it takes place almost fully within Philadelphia, and very specifically almost fully within the neighborhood of Kensington, while ranging through a number of different institutions in the city. There's so many moments that are captured in this book that will be familiar to those of us at least certainly in the last 10 to 20 years, although it even goes beyond that. In history, characters that we recognize, that certainly I recognize, villains and heroes, Paul Vallis, politicians like Michael Nutter, Helen Gim, Larry Krasner, institutions, the Institute for Contemporary Art, the LGBTQ organization, Galais, and a number of different neighborhoods in the city. And it's a beautiful portrait of the city in that sense, and just taking so much in. So I'm excited to talk about the book as a portrait and a study of how poverty works and devastates people in the United States, but especially I want to talk about it first as a portrait of our city. And I'm curious, we came to know each other in part both as writers and in part as political figures, myself as a politician and yourself as a senior policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. So we also we'll talk about policy, but I'm curious what brought you to this story here in Philadelphia?
Sure. Well, first, I just want to say thank you all for being here, and thanks to the Free Library of Philadelphia for organizing this event, a great public institution, and really want to thank Nick Hill for being in conversation. We actually first connected because we had when I wrote my book, Schools on Trial, we had the same editor, Jerry Howard, at Doubleday, and very indebted to Nick Hill's work, Cubed, and some of his other writings for N+1 and others. So really happy to be here. And it's very funny, in addition to that, because not a week or month goes by where I'm misidentified as Nick Hill Saval in various capacities. So people will be very confused if they see this online.
There are two.
But yeah, it's I appreciate that overview. I mean, I think what I was quite struck by, and maybe I can start with a little bit about my introduction to the city. I first started visiting Philadelphia just over a decade ago. I was interested in examining public education, first visited the Workshop School, which was first located down at the Navy Yard and has since moved West Philly. And it came at a time when the city was going through a lot of turbulence in education policy, mass school closures, austerity measures. And I returned to the city in 2015 for a couple of reasons. One, I was interested in examining the high school dropout crisis. And I had reached out to a friend named Andrew Frischman, who runs an organization called Big Picture Learning. And it's an organization that has dozens of public progressive student-centered schools around the country. And he said, you should go visit El Centro de Estudiantes, this last chance alternative high school in the Kensington neighborhood of Philadelphia. And I thought I was just going to write a story, interview some students and teachers and some staff and call it a day. But it began to snowball into a much larger project because I went off to grad school, conducted an ethnographic study in the neighborhood, made that my part of my master's and PhD, and then began to turn that project into this book, into, I would say, a readable version of the dissertation, and as you know very well. But when I was spending those original couple of months and years in the neighborhood and in the school, it was really important for me to examine this through the lens of political economy, that it wasn't simply enough to examine these kids' lives in the scope of El Centro, that the issues of housing insecurity and gun violence and hunger and incarceration and domestic violence and all the other social and economic ills and problems, those don't get left behind when children walk into school every day. They get carried into the school. They affect a child's ability to learn. And so if I was going to write and narrate the most genuine and full version of this story, then I had to root my analysis both in these kids' lives, but also within the larger economic and political institutions that influence their daily being and their aspirations. So, you know, when I first came here, when I started to spend some time here, I was really struck just by the differences among neighbors. I mean, Philadelphia, as you all know, it's a city of neighborhoods. And I would start, I would spend a lot of time in South Philly and in Society Hill, and I would take the 47 bus uptown to Kensington. And it was very disorienting to me because, you know, whether I was taking the 47 bus or I was taking the L, within just a few minutes, you would see a completely different quality of life, completely radically different conditions in each neighborhood. You know, at the beginning of the book, I cite a very harrowing statistic that I learned about life expectancy, where the babies born in Society Hill, you know, predominantly white, upper middle class, affluent neighborhood, the babies there are living 17 years more on average than the babies born in Kensington. So 71 years of life expectancy versus 88 years of life expectancy. That is a massive contrast. And so when my former boss, Senator Sanders, talks about how poverty is a death sentence, I can't think of a more acute representation of that than the discrepancy or dichotomy between Society Hill and Kensington. So yeah, so the book, in many respects, provides that landscape, the history of the neighborhood, the legacy of public policy, and up into the modern day, to understand how we arrived at the conditions in Kensington and in North Philadelphia.
So the book is a portrait of a city, of a neighborhood, of a, I believe, you know, hyper-segregated city, which, you know, many of us are familiar with. And it is a portrait through three young people, Ryan, John Carlos, and Corum, whose dead name is Emmanuel, and there's a story there. How did you, you know, we'll get into the kind of details of the story, but how did you, you mentioned meeting the students. Of course, I would assume that it's not a given that you'd be able to tell their stories. How did you build trust, you know, in coming into Philadelphia, meeting with young people, and build trust with them and their families?
So I engage in, as I mentioned, a type of research called ethnography. And ethnography is a methodology where a researcher embeds themselves within a community, an institution, some setting to examine that various phenomena. And that requires interviewing and observation, something called participant observation, drawing on various methodologies, digital methods, other forms of data collection, surveys, with the ultimate goal of producing usually ethnographic portraits. And so at El Centro, I interviewed hundreds of kids. It was amazing because the school gave me full access, and you know I'm very grateful for that. They just let me wander the school. I would be able to walk into any classroom and sit in and on classes and observe, and they were happy. They were okay with it, which I will never understand why they did that. But it was I'm still very grateful for that. And you know, I would usually start with just asking pretty generic questions like, "Tell me about your experience at El Centro. Tell me about your previous school experiences. You know, what are your hobbies?" And then I'd sometimes ask open-ended questions such as, "If the mayor of Philadelphia were sitting right here, what would you tell that person? If you had a magic wand and you could change three things about your community, what would they be?" You know, pretty simple kind of boilerplate questions, but ones that I thought were helpful to evoke conversation and discussion. You know, I wasn't too dissimilar in age to a number of these students, just either a couple years older or even similar, the same age as a number of the students. So that, I think, helped. But I was coming in as, in some degree, as an authority figure. I was wearing business casual clothing. I looked different from other kids in the neighborhood. So there was that kind of wall that I had to overcome. And to build trust took a lot of time. You know, for a lot of students, talking about, for example, the criminal justice system it can be a very fearful activity. I think students originally thought I was a snitch or an informant. You know, I was going to rat them out to the police. And it was only after a process of consistently showing up in their lives, of showing that I actually genuinely cared about their lives and their experiences and their opinions, that they began to open up to me. And it took a lot of time, you know, even for Emmanuel, known as Karem, it took about 4 years for them to introduce me to their mother. You know, they were estranged for some time, didn't feel comfortable introducing me, and then eventually we all met at Applebee's and we became friends and we started talking. And so that process took enormous, I think, amount of strength and perseverance. And so I think the ethnographic method was very helpful to both depict their lives, but also to position it within a larger political and social structure.
And, you know, you describe the interviews and spending time with the children, but I mean, there are transcripts of text message exchanges. There's, you know, presumably like otherwise inaccessible, like Facebook posts. There are just details in this that are diaries, you know, private diaries written together with intimate partners. That strikes me as like a level of just real trust that,
right,
that you know, I haven't read in many works of academic sociology.
Yeah. I think it goes to the fact that I was interviewing kids, and I think there's been very, very, I think, few narrative nonfiction books done well about children. And I think to actually create those kind of relationships is not something that can be done just by parachuting into a community. You have to really embed yourself in there. And, you know, the issue, you know, you mentioned some of these archival pieces of data. I found Instagram and Facebook to be very helpful, where I would become friends with these kids on Instagram, and I would go through their feeds, with, you know, obviously with their permission, and I'd go through their photos, and we'd sit down, and I'd talk to them about each photo. And what does this photo represent? What was happening at that moment? You know, for Giancarlos in particular, he has just lost countless loved ones to gun violence. And his Instagram feed was one way to memorialize those memories and those photos with his friends. And so that was one way for me to essentially to collect data, you know, to put it in that kind of very scientific way, but to understand their lives. And I learned, you know, quite interestingly, and one day I'll hopefully write a methodology paper on this, but for some of these students who, when they left El Centro, I kept in touch with them, I found that Instagram was the best way to keep in touch, where a lot of kids would, they would change their numbers very, very often, but they would always keep their Instagram account because they didn't want to lose their followers. So even if they were incarcerated, they might lose their phone number, but they always had their profile on hand. So I learned some of these kind of clever, interesting tactics to connect with them. And then, you know, the other piece of the historical work was, you know, at the beginning of the book, I tell the story of Ryan and his journey through the juvenile justice system and at an alternative disciplinary school. His mother kept, after more than a decade, just a trove of documents, of school records, of diary notes, of court transcripts and records that helped me as a researcher paint a very vivid and full picture of what he had experienced. I think without that, the book would not read, I think, as well as it does. So I'm very grateful that they were willing to share those resources.
So let's talk a little bit about Ryan. I mean, because there's the book, you know, essentially opens with an incident, right? And there are a number of such incidents over the course of the book that are, you know, take place within a school and are disciplinary incidents that are in some ways in the context of the book, and there's a reason why this is, are irrevocable. They lead to irrevocable changes in these young students' lives. So can you talk a little bit about the kind of opening, the vignette of the fire that kind of transforms Ryan's life?
Sure. So I start the book off with a scene where Ryan, who is attending Grover Washington Middle School.
Ryan is, remind us what his ethnicity is.
Oh, yeah. So Ryan, Puerto Rican youth. He is 12 years old, just about to turn 13, raised by a single mom who grew up in the United States, but had family in Puerto Rico. So, he's at this middle school called Grover Washington. It's just a normal day. He's engaging in mischief. He, you know, had a learning disability, had racked up, you know, dozens of disciplinary slips, you know, was known as a kid who had behavioral issues at the school. And so he's engaging in some mischief with some friends, and he and his friends started lighting pieces of paper on fire and then smothering them out with their shoes. And then one of them decides to challenge the others to light some pieces of paper on fire and leave it in a trash can. And so this goes on, you know, these games and antics go on for a couple of minutes, and you know Ryan is involved with this, and then they leave a burning piece of paper in a trash can in a school hallway, and then they leave. And you know a little bit later, you know Ryan is just about to go into the lunchroom, and the school principal and dean spot him out and say, "You're coming with us. You know, we're going to the room where the school resource officers are stationed." And school resource officers are police officers who are assigned to schools. And over the next period of time, Ryan, with a group of other students who were targeted or singled out, are then interrogated by the school principal and dean. And they, you know, no parent, no guardian, no adult, no other adult present. And then Ryan confesses to be the child on the video, you know, the surveillance tape. You know, I'm the guy who, in the white shirt, who set the trash can on fire. And then that leads to Ryan getting arrested. You know, two Philadelphia Police Department officers come into the school. They actually parade him around the school because he has to pick up his stuff from his locker, and they parade him around the school. Everybody is literally coming up, you know, coming up to the doors of the classroom, putting their faces against the windows to see what's happening. And, you know, Ryan just, you know, this kind of perp walk out of the school building. And so, you know, long story short, he gets sent to the Youth Study Center, the juvenile justice center in the city at the time, and then gets funneled into another juvenile detention center, Glen Mills, in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And so, and this is a 12-year-old boy. You know, this is a child. I just want to remind you. And then I tell the story of how Ryan is then, when he comes back to Grover, Washington, he's expelled and gets sent to a for-profit disciplinary school called Community Education Partners. Some of you might know about CEP. You'll have to jog your memory a little bit because this was in the early 2000s. But CEP was a for-profit company started by a group of men who had ties to the Republican Party. And they had a pitch to school districts. This was happening at a time in the 1990s where there was fear of quote-unquote super predators and a generation of young criminals rising up and going to maraud the American public. You know, there was the Columbine school shooting. And so there was a lot of interest, fascination, and fear of juvenile crime. And so CEP told school districts all over the country, they said, you have a group of students who are disobedient, who have behavioral issues, who have low test scores, who don't come to school on time, who even if they're coming to school, are not engaged, give them to us. We will warehouse them. We will keep them away from the rest of the students so your test scores and your graduation rates and all your other metrics are not going to be affected by this. And so they got their first contracts in Dallas and Houston schools. And this model was exported all over the country. And in the early 2000s, it was brought to Philadelphia. You know, just around the time that Paul Dallas came onto the scene, became the CEO of Philadelphia schools, and CEP executives lobbied very hard in Harrisburg to convince lawmakers and on both sides of the aisle that you should give alternative school funding to these to disciplinary school providers. It was the first for-profit disciplinary school provider that was given a contract in the city in 2002. And so Ryan came of age during that period of time at a period of very heightened zero tolerance, exclusionary disciplinary policy. Vallis drilled in on that of suspensions and expulsions and disciplinary school transfers. There was also a policy on the book where, say you committed a juvenile offense and you were sent to a juvenile detention center, then you were not allowed to come back to your traditional neighbor at school. You had to first go to a disciplinary school to be, you know, conditioned and retrained, and then only then you could come back to your neighbor at school. But in reality, it meant that very few kids actually ended up coming back to their neighbor at school. And so it was essentially building a pipeline of customers into this for-profit school. And I actually forgot one of the key points, which was that CEP, one of their early investors was Thomas Beasley. Some of you might know that name. He is the co-founder of the world's first and largest private prison enterprise. So to me, it's just harrowing just to think about the tentacles of these different systems. So Ryan gets sent to CEP and against the wish of his mother. And, you know, this, I think, comes across in the book a number of times. You know, parents, despite the fact living in deep poverty and desperation, are still incredible advocates for their children. And Rainey, I think, is a textbook example of that. I mentioned the archives that she kept. But she fought to prevent him from going to CEP. She tried to convince the disciplinary school, the school officials at the disciplinary hearing at the district. She tried to convince the judge not to send him there. And so he was sent to the school. He had to walk into school, had to wear a uniform, go through a metal detector, get stopped and frisked by a security guard. Then he and his classmates had to walk with their hands behind their backs into what was called a community. They had to walk into community. They could not leave that community until the end of the day. Constant fighting, violence, little formal instruction. In many respects, it was a warehouse. It was just designed to keep the bad kids away from everybody else. I would even argue that in some respects, it was a school for the educational untouchables, the surplus youth, the kids that were deemed disposable and not fully human, not deserving of rights. And so I trace that story over time and his tribulations and struggles with the juvenile system. And, you know, you alluded to this earlier, but this experience with the juvenile system would dog him for the rest of his childhood and even into adulthood. It would be used, it would be brought up and invoked in family court when he was trying to fight for custody of his son, where a judge, the fire incident was brought up and in some respects was used to undermine his ability to be a caring father, an incident as a 12-year-old. So it's just harrowing tale, and I think it illustrates a number of clear crises and problems in both the school system and the juvenile justice system.
I see a lot of folks shaking their heads in the audience. I mean, in part, it's a harrowing story, and in part, I mean, some of the kind of characters and actors are known to some of us. It is amazing. I think one of the aspects of the book is the way through these individuals, these who are made very real and whose lives we come to understand really well and whose families we understand, we're also following the trajectories of American social policy and the undoing of aspects of the welfare state, such as it is, and the educational system here in Philadelphia, in particular, over the course of a decade and more. There are just so many instances that many of us will remember. It is also, as I mentioned earlier, the portrait of a neighborhood. And a neighborhood that I actually in part in my job partly represent in the first Senate district, which is the neighborhood of Kensington, and it ranges. There's also Juniata. There's other part. There's other parts. Hunting Park. There are other parts of the city that are in the book, but Kensington is sort of where we linger. And I'm curious. It has achieved a kind of talismanic or just kind of like a byword for a certain urban setting. I'm wondering if you can kind of talk about Kensington and what is Kensington? Like what is the Kensington that the students inhabit in the book? Like how did Kensington become Kensington, and what sort of pathways maybe were missed? And
sure. Yeah, I think it's really important to tell the history of Kensington and understand these historical legacies if we're going to address the crises that exist in the neighborhood today. In the book, I trace the history of the neighborhood all the way from the rise of the textile empire in the 19th and 20th century to its collapse. And I won't go through the full story, but, El Centro de Estudiantes, where these three kids attended and would try to graduate from, it was founded by a man named David Bromley, an educator who grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia, went to private schools. And by some sheer coincidence, when he came, he had spent some time in California and started some schools there and decided to come back to Philadelphia. By sheer coincidence, when he was looking for real estate for this new school, El Centro de Estudiantes, he learned that a number of the abandoned buildings were Bromley textile mills. And he had known a little bit about his family's history growing up. He knew that he was very wealthy and they were in business, but he had no idea about where these factories were located and the scope of it. And he just stumbles upon this coincidence, this situation in Kensington. And then he meets one union organizer one day this one man. And this man says, are you a Bromley? And David said, yes, I'm a Bromley. And the guy says, I used to be a union organizer and the Bromleys were the worst bosses because they tried to bust our unions. And so in many respects, the book and the journey of David starting El Centro is a reconciling with his family's legacy in this neighborhood. And, this was a neighborhood that was the site of the world's largest and most diverse textile industry. Just millions of yards of goods and millions of different textile goods and products were produced on virtually almost every block of Kensington. And, people would say that you could drop out of high school one day and within a couple hours get a job in one of these factories and a job that would provide you with a decent middle class lifestyle with, some wages, salary, pension, benefits, healthcare, and so forth. And, a blue-collar livelihood. And so, I traced the legacy of the neighborhood over time, and so David is reconciling with the fact that here's a neighborhood that was fundamentally looted of its wealth and resources by his family. And now he's starting a school in this place that has become the poorest neighborhood in Philadelphia. Some of the highest levels of incarceration, crime, food insecurity, lack of healthcare, and other metrics. So these kids are growing up in that age. And in addition to the rise and fall of industrial policy and the textile industry, I also trace the history of the war on drugs and welfare reform and the Puerto Rican migration and how compounded these systems and these histories have targeted specific groups of people, have denied them their fair share of resources and wealth, and produced the level of inordinate suffering and inequality that exist in this neighborhood. And, you know, Kensington today is treated as this kind of spectacle of suffering. It's used as this punching bag by Republican and Democratic lawmakers and for various capacities. And I think this book tries to do is, one, to just put these people's lives at the center of the narrative, let them speak for themselves, let them tell the world what they want people to know about their neighborhood, and then two, to actually show that we can change these conditions in Kensington, that they are not inevitable, that if they're the result of public policy, of relations of power, of concentration of wealth and resources seized from the poor working class to the very, very rich, if those are the consequences that we are living under, that we can change that. And I think that's what the end of the book tries to do as well, in providing somewhat of a blueprint that underfunded schools and gun violence and premature death and lack of affordable, nutritious food, all those things can be changed with public policy and the sufficient political will.
There is a lot of, and we can talk about this, right, but there's a lot of protest, of social explosions, of, you know, that I, again, some of us have lived through in Philadelphia, the hunger strike that greeted mass layoffs and mass closures of schools in 2013. One of the characters, or one of the students, is an activist with Youth United for Change, right. YUC. You know, there's a lot, there are many kind of figures in the book who push against the bureaucracies. And so as much as it is a, you know, a very sobering
right.
book, there are figures, there are people, there are institutions, or certainly people within institutions that try to do things differently. And I think there's a positive kind of, things can be different.
And and I was going to say, like, that to me is a core piece of the book, that people like Giancarlo and others who engage in these organizing efforts are fundamentally political actors, that these policies and institutions, yes, they happen to people, they are pushed onto people, but people resist, people contest those relations of power and those inequities. And I think Giancarlo, I think, is a textbook example of that, where he got involved with Youth United for Change, an educational justice group here in the city, actually based in Kensington. And, you know, also just to note, Philadelphia has this really storied legacy of incredible educational justice organizing, particularly from young people. I mean, this has existed all over this country, but I think Philadelphia really stands out with the work of the Philadelphia Student Union and Youth United for Change. And they have been on the front lines of virtually every single education fight in the city, whether it was in the 2000s when the state took over the Philadelphia schools and essentially auctioned off large numbers of schools to Edison schools and other private school providers, whether it was in 2013 when Philadelphia closed 24 public schools and made punishing austerity cuts to the schools and to the staff and the teaching workforce. Students were on the front lines fighting against that. And Giancarlo came of age during that school closure fight, would stand with a bullhorn on the back of a truck just in front of the school district building on Broad Street with his peers who had walked out of school saying that, "Don't close our schools, fund our schools. Tell Harrisburg to fund our schools to make sure that every child has extracurricular activities, small classes, well-paid teachers, restorative justice, sports and extracurricular activities, you know, all the things that make up a good, decent education." So they took matters into their own hands when the adults failed them. And they were in coalition with labor unions and other social justice groups in the city. And while they didn't win many of these fights, they learned how to organize and they learned how to engage in civic mobilization, and whether it was in voting or in canvassing or in other forms of political action. There were some smaller victories, you know, for example, just changing the some of the language around the dress code to include students who are gender nonconforming and so forth. So that was worked with YUC and the Philadelphia Student Union. So Giancarlos is an important character and actor and piece of the story, his resistance against educational privatization and his own experiences dealing with exclusionary school discipline and then coming to El Centro later on.
I think this is a great time to open it up to the audience.
Good evening, gentlemen. I have two questions, one for the senator and one for the author. Senator, you mentioned Michael Nutter. There is no problem that the author mentioned, and Mayor Monk Michael Nutter didn't actually discuss it and didn't suggest a solution for it. Michael Nutter was, let's put it this way, he was it takes a villager after Hillary Clinton. Michael Nutter ran and was a delegate for Hillary Clinton. There is nothing that said that Michael Nutter didn't was really after it and suggest a solution. But now it looks like we came back to square one. Where is Michael Nutter? My question to the author, in the piece that you read, it looks like you did jump from the poverty of the character to his homosexuality. Are you suggesting that there is correlation between his poverty and his homosexuality? Because, you know, in a conservative environment, conservative women are high maintenance and hard to get. So are you suggesting by juxtaposing his poverty, his homosexuality right next to his poverty, are you suggesting correlation?
So I chose those passages just to illustrate the plight that Emmanuel was enduring during his childhood. I would just point out that a lot of LGBTQ youth in the city and other places in this country, especially those living in particularly low-income and working-class backgrounds, feel the brunt of those challenges more so than others. And especially when it comes to an issue like housing, if they are rejected from their parents and their family members, there are very, very few places for them to go. And, you know, fortunately here in the city, there was an LGBTQ homeless shelter that took Emmanuel in and provided him a sanctuary. It allowed him to graduate high school because otherwise he had nowhere else to go. So, you know, I think and the work of GLAY and some of these other groups are instrumental in supporting queer and gender nonconforming youth and other youth in providing them a space to listen and to respond to their needs and to care for them, because there are unfortunately too few of these places in our society that really do that in a dignified way.
Just briefly, I mean, I don't have much to say about the former mayor. I mean, but I would just say that a number of us who are active in politics and education, you know, now we're in some ways transformed by the movements, and some of which are described in this book, for educational justice and for against privatization that took place in the early part of the last decade in the late 2000s and 2010s. I was an organizer, researcher with the union Unite Here, which represents hospitality workers, but in particular cafeteria workers and noontime, what used to be called noontime aides in the school district of Philadelphia. All of the entire class of workers, noontime aides, were laid off in that sort of series of cuts engineered by the district and the administration. And workers went on hunger strike to protest them. And that's also described. Mm. In this book, that was all those events, the coalitions around that, the fights against privatization, the fights against the closure of libraries. You know, these were things that were transformative. You know, I think for many people and drove many people into politics because we felt like there was another model. And you know, frankly, we were pushed by figures like Giancarlos, by Youth United for Change, by PSU, because students led those walkouts. They led the marches. They were the most eloquent spokespeople for what people were going through.
How old were the three boys featured in the book during the time of the book?
So I met them around 2015, 2016. So, I mean, I can tell you today. So Ryan is 28, Giancarlos is 24, and Emmanuel Karem now is 25, turning 26, I believe.
How old were they in the time of the book?
Oh, so generally ranging from 15 to the book ends around 2020. So, yeah, 3 years younger than all the ages I just mentioned.
Did you make the decision as an author to focus so narrowly on early adolescent and boys?
Sure. So I was interested, as I mentioned, in the high school dropout crisis. So I wanted to look at that high school-aged population. As part of the ethnography, I interviewed hundreds of kids of all types of genders, and I ended up choosing these three because, for a number of reasons. One, they had very good memories, so they could help me reconstruct pivotal and seminal moments of their childhoods. Some of them had really strong archival data, like Ryan, for example. They were all of them were willing to talk to me for extended periods of time. They were not completely bothered by me. And then they also illustrated, in each of their own way, different institutions and structures and some of the larger histories at play. So Emmanuel Karem now uses they, them pronouns. I previously had a woman as one of the other main characters, but I lost track of her. I think she ended up moving out of the city, lost track of her. But it was my hope to have a woman as part of the kind of cast main characters. And as part of that, to rectify that, it was important for me to not just trace the lives of these kids, but also the lives of their mothers. And I think throughout the book, you see that there are the three mothers and their struggles and their upbringings are, I think, very clearly portrayed throughout the narrative as well. And it, you know, provides an intergenerational account of poverty and incarceration and inequality from one generation to another, not because of cultural or behavioral or genetic issues, but because that people are often living in similar conditions of deprivation. So I think that, to me, tries to fill the gap of where it might be missing in the three main characters.
Good evening. My name is Asantwa Nkrumah Ture. Hi, Senator. And I'm with an organization called the Justice for Angel Davis Now campaign. Some of you may recall two women were shot during what we call landlord terrorist officer evictions. And that's another story, too. But for the characters in your book, their friends, their neighbors, etc., have any of these young people actually lived through an eviction? Because I'm hearing more and more about young people, small children, teenagers who have lived through an eviction, whether it be a quote-unquote regular eviction or a violent one or almost violent one done by, you know, a landlord who does it on their own, and how that may affect their perspective on a lot of things.
Sure. Well, you know, Emmanuel, growing up, he and Yvette lived off of less than $10,000 a year in SSI, Supplemental Security Income, and TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, plus food stamps. So that's just a meager amount of money. That's living in deep poverty. And so it meant that Yvette would have to choose between paying the rent and putting food on the table. That was a constant struggle, or even just buying a school uniform. And so that meant that she often had to deal with evictions. And I describe in the book the kind of harrowing experience that Emmanuel has of being forced to upend his life, you know, just month after month, lose his friendships, lose his relationships with his teachers, move into a different neighbor of the city, and the effects and the toll that it had on his mental health, his well-being, his education. You know, Ryan as well dealt with the evictions and housing insecurity. He failed one of his grades because the house that he was living in caught fire and they had to move out of that neighborhood. So this was a constant struggle of finding decent, affordable housing. And unfortunately, that remains very much so the case for a lot of these kids. And, you know, people ask me about, you know, what types of policies would you enact to make these kids' lives better? And I would say that investing in housing and tenant protections, but particularly investing in more housing, all types of housing, would have a major impact on providing these children with a safe place to live. Chronic absenteeism is a major crisis in this country, and one of the root causes is homelessness and housing insecurity. And we have to go to the root cause of that. And I think, you know, here in the city, there's some important efforts around expanding the housing supply, and I think there should be more, and I think other cities need to do that. And also to build social housing as well, where there's a process of mixed income development, where we are not just segregating people by income and just replicating the kind of policies of the 1970s of building these very large public housing towers, but actually building very habitable, mixed income, mixed rise communities where people can be there for generations. So those are a couple of things I would suggest.
So we are out of time, but the author I know will be happy to answer, talk more policy and sign books outside. Thank you all so much for coming. Thank you. And please join me in thanking and welcoming once again, Snikkel Goyal.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.